are Idaho
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind. You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Hi, this is Pat Matheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO here in
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such primetime players as Jason Moran, Diane Reeves, Christian McBride, Terrence Blanchard, and John Schofield. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on audio, then podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this November. Nonpartisan voter information is at lwvpdx.org.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting...
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Hello and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today I'm speaking with Dory Midnight.
You know, systems of domination rely on severing these connections. And the threat of violence and obliteration and loss of connection leaves people feeling really vulnerable and afraid. And that, in turn, really, I think, becomes fertile ground for adopting toxic mimics of protection.
Dory Midnight practices intuitive healing, weaves collaborative, liberatory ritual spaces, makes potions, and writes liturgy, spells, prayers, and poems. For over 20 years, Dory has been practicing and teaching on ritual and remedies for unraveling times, reconnecting with traditions of Jewish ancestral wisdom, community care work, and queer magic and healing. Dory's work is supported and inspired by a web of teachers, dreamers, and co-conspirators in disability and healing justice work, queer liberation, and earth-based, multi-rooted diasporic Judaism, and is in service to more love, more healing, and more freedom for everybody. Raised on Tongva land, Los Angeles, Dory currently lives on unceded Pukumtuk Nimpuk land, Western Massachusetts. Oh, Dory, I am so gleeful and grateful to be sharing this time with you today. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Ayana. It's such a gift to get to be with you.
Well, I want to start off by just saying how inspired I am by all the ways your work weaves together magical and liberatory practices. And I think it'd be great to begin by locating us within your lineages, as well as if you could speak a bit about your healing offerings and your origin in healing justice work.
So I love this question because my great-grandmother, whenever she would meet someone, the first thing she would ask was, "Who are your people?" And I think it's a really beautiful way to get to know somebody and like feel the way that we are more than just our little selves in this lifetime. So I can speak a little bit about some of my lineages, and starting with my ancestors of blood. My dad's side are Jews from the Pale of Settlement, so the region between the Baltic and the Black Sea, where Jews were exiled by the Russian Empire. So they are from Romania and Latvia and Ukraine. Those are what that land is called now. And they came to the US in like the late 1800s, like around 1890 something, through New York City. And they lived on the Lower East Side and in Brooklyn for a couple generations before going to the Midwest. And that side of my family were very religious. They're Orthodox and also Hasidic Jews. And you know, that journey is like of when they came to the US and how that things shifted for them religiously, spiritually, culturally. Like there's this amazing story about my great grandmother, like when she got to the US, she loved bacon and she would like cook bacon and then smoke a whole pack of cigarettes to cover up the smell of bacon, which I feel like is a perfect little story about assimilation and her story of assimilation. And on my mom's side is a little bit more mysterious and unknown and complicated. My mom's mom was an orphan. Her mom died when she was an infant, and she was in and out of orphanages and foster homes for her whole childhood. So I don't know much about her story, her family. And my mom's dad was Jewish and came from his family. His parents immigrated when his mom was pregnant with him and he was born in the US. And they came from the Ukraine, but they were, from what I understand, they were Sephardic. So their kind of like longer roots, their deeper roots were from the Balkans and Iberian Peninsula and, you know, that Mediterranean region. And that side of my family, of my Jewish family, were more secular. And in fact, like that side of, like a bunch of his cousins and relatives were kind of like secular lefty socialists who moved out to, they were in the Midwest and moved out to LA in the 20s and were involved in, you know, all kinds of Jewish lefty shenanigans. So those are my blood people. And in terms of my lineage of practice and my chosen people, I really, you know, connect my healing practice feels like it's sort of in the flow of rivers of Jewish healing traditions. And some of those people call themselves sanadoras or precantadoras. Those are Ladino names, buenas madres, and also Ashkenazi healers, halers, ospreskers, people who carried ancestral wisdom and listened deeply and tended to their communities with love and care. And some of whom just, you know, didn't have titles, who just did that kind of listening and tending out of kitchens and homes. And, you know, I came of age, like in terms of sort of how I came into my own healing practice, something that I was always oriented to as a young person. My great-grandmother, the one I talked about, the bacon-eating, cigarette-smoking one, Frances, I grew up at her feet. And when I was like 6 or 7, I always loved to tie her shoes. And when I was like 6 or 7, she joined the trend of getting Velcro shoes. And she had these like Jordache, these like hot pink Jordache sneakers that were shiny. And I was sitting at her feet, like with our little tradition of me tying her shoes. And it was sort of like neither one of us could give up that practice, even though she no longer had shoelaces. And she took my face in her hand and she looked at me and she was like, "You have an old soul. You are a storyteller. You are going to keep the stories alive. You and those little blue eyes of yours." You know, I was like this anomaly in my family, all who have like these beautiful chocolatey brown eyes. And I came out with these blue eyes and nobody knew where I came from. And she was like, "You are going to remember the stories and you are going to bring these stories through." And I think, you know, I just soaked up everything she said to me. You know, she like gave her plants little, when they like looked wilty and unhappy, she would give them a sprinkle of vodka. And, you know, she gave me these bobby pins when I was a kid. She chopped her hair. She had these long braids that she wrapped in like cinnamon rolls around her ears. And when she cut her hair, she gave me her little tin of bobby pins. And she was like, "Bobby pins, these metals keep the demons away." So it was like always like she was dropping little bits of wisdom. And so I feel like she's sort of one of my main and first teachers, and also like gave me a lot of direction and guidance and purpose, and still does, you know, even though she's spirit now. And I, you know, I think like I was very connected to the spirit world as a young person, and, you know, and also was like loved dancing. I grew up in the valley in LA, and, you know, I was like full of multitudes. And then in my teens and 20s, like I came of age in like a community of really politicized queer witches in the Bay Area in the 90s and 2000s, and just was like, you know, hanging with radical fairies and leather dykes and organizers and sex workers. And I was also at the time also like really immersing myself in rivers of radical diasporist Jewish lesbian feminists and unlearning Zionism. And at that same time, I was diagnosed with cancer in my early 20s. And so that really initiated me into you know, kind of like being scooped up into the loving arms of other sick and disabled people. And, you know, what now is called by, you know, Kara Page and Susan Raffo and Leah Lakshmi and, you know, other beloveds, like disability justice, healing justice work. And at the time was just like sick and disabled friends caring for each other and being with each other in these ways. So like that was sort of the cauldron that I was in my young adult time that, yeah, initiated me into my own healing, my own personal healing, and in the cauldron of like queerness and queer liberation and kind of radical, magical worlds. And also was at the same time, like I was apprenticing the person who I was seeing for healing work, this amazing now crone, Kabele, and in learning about intuitive healing and stones and plants. And so it was really like my own healing process, my own, you know, ongoing forever lifetime healing that I'm still doing, but at the time like in a very explicit way around sexual violence and trauma and chronic illness, and at the same time experiencing all this like joy and abundance and expansiveness in with all these like magical, sparkly weirdos and freaks and in the Bay. And so those are definitely also my people, that is like, you know, thicker than blood community people and loved ones and chosen ones.
Wow, what a beautiful and really personal introduction you shared with us. I really appreciate your willingness to share so much of yourself. I really was with you as you were sharing these stories, like seeing you with your grandma and in the Bay Area and just the wardrobes of the times, and like I really saw it in my mind. And there's so much I could ask from this point, but I guess one thing that I have really been thinking about is this article you wrote titled Jewish Plant Magic Rooting In. And in it you ask your ancestors, quote, how do we know what we know if they didn't write books? And so much was lost through assimilation, sexism, racism, anti-Semitism, end quote. And I want to pose this question to you now. How do we know what we know? And I think this is a question of intuition and trusting intuition. And I think it's really challenging for so many of us to trust those inner voices now more than ever, because there is so much noise. There is noise with the media, with social media, with people's opinions. I think that the dominant culture has done a really good job designing ways for us to not trust our intuition and trust this inner knowing of our past. And so I want to pose some of those thoughts to you. And if you see that as well, what are ways that you inform others of how to start to reconnect to that intuition again and combat so much of the distraction and energy that tries to tell us that that's not true, correct, valuable, and so on and so forth?
Thank you for that question, and thanks for all your questions. I really do, like most of the time of my days, I spend asking other people questions and doing a lot of deep listening. And so it's fun and an adjustment to be talking and being the one asked. I guess I think about this story that, this like very classic Jewish story that my mom told me when I was a kid, which is the story that before you were born, when you were just like a little soul, maybe you were just a little sparkle, or maybe it was like when you were, you know, kind of like cooking away inside somebody's uterus, you knew everything. You knew all the wisdom of the universe. You knew languages, and you knew, you know, maybe you knew physics, or you knew, had all these skills and knowledge. And the story goes that then you're born. And as soon as you were born, an angel came. And not only did this angel bless you, but this angel tapped you on that little spot above your lip, that little indentation under your nose. You can just like place your fingertip there and see how it fits in so perfectly. And when the angel tapped you there, everything, you forgot everything. It's just like, zoop, it's all gone. And like every Jewish story, this can, you know, this can be interpreted so many ways. And something that I love about this story, or what's really powerful about it to me, is that then it becomes that like learning is a remembering. And it's like a remembering what we knew, and something that we already knew, that we knew in our souls, or we knew in our bodies, or whatever the differences between those things are. And that we have access, we can remember what our ancestors did. And, but also, you know, I think this remembering, especially in the context of empire and modernity and white supremacy and trauma, like that the remembering is an act of resistance, and the remembering is an act of healing. And so, yeah, I guess I feel like the learning about these things is like an unveiling, or a recovering, or a revealing of these wisdoms. And, you know, every time I talk about these things with other people, or teach about these things, or, you know, do healing work with people, it's like this moment of like familiarity or recognition, or like, do I really get to have this inheritance? And also like, this feels so familiar, or somehow I feel like I already knew this. And so I think that can be a really powerful experience in terms of like what that affirmation of our intuition feels like. I think we need that affirmation, and I think we really need each other to do this remembering. Like, I think one of the things, like you were talking about this, like the noise and the culture that is such a, you know, an attack, so undermining to being able to hear ourselves, to be able to hear our intuition, trust our intuition, but it also like makes it hard to hear and trust each other. And I do feel like this kind of remembering is a collective practice, and we need each other in this practice to help reflect these things and to help each other remember. And, you know, we do carry these, we carry these traditions in our bodies, in our dreams, in folk tales and songs, in the memories of our grandparents and great grandparents. They're hidden in our rituals and prayers, and many of these practices are still alive and well. And I think that's important to remember too, that not all is lost, and like the scale and quality of the loss of these traditions really varies between different Jewish diasporas. And so it's also really important to honor and celebrate the richness of these practices that have remained vibrant, and also the resilience of those who have kept them alive. And, you know, I mean, and in the face of centuries of empire and colonialism and Orientalism and state violence and exile and patriarchy, and, you know, the list goes on, so many of these healing practices have been lost and hidden and suppressed, or obscured and subsumed and sort of like recast into religion, and kind of like lost their, you know, for lack of a better word, their magic. And with that remembering, it's also like, I feel like it's essential to say, you know, like, this is not a practice of romanticizing or fetishizing, or kind of like, you know, like resisting nostalgia about it, but also like bringing forth this wisdom. And then, you know, I feel like part of my work and the work that so many of us are engaged in is like living it, adapting it, and pointing these legacies towards liberation, which I think is, for me, like what I really understand Judaism to be a practice of, is like, this is a living tradition. This is a tradition that has always adapted to the context that we are living in. It has always responded and remained connected to something ancient and as reverence, but also like wrestling and tumbling and getting down and dirty with text. And so like, yeah, like I think that all you need is like a scrap or a seed or a fragment or a story. You know, so much of Jewish study and Jewish practices, like you can unfold a single letter and derive so much meaning. Like there are mystical practices in Judaism of meditating on breath or on one single letter, let alone a word or a phrase, let alone like an entire psalm or prayer, or a practice of just like throwing some salt, braiding bread, lighting a candle. And so I guess one thing I want to say is it's like, it doesn't take much. Like there's a lot in the way of accessing these things, including a feeling of like not being Jewish enough or not being the right kind of Jewish, or you know, different ways that people's families assimilated for survival, for safety. And so giving ourselves permission and giving each other permission to access these things and encouraging each other to get messy and make mistakes and being willing to like fumble and not know and being really forgiving and loving with each other while at the same time like being rigorous and being in integrity and you know, doing our studies and our research together in a way of like being in practice, like before we go out and teach something or something, you know. So it's like a lot of listening and moving slowly and with intention. And also, you know, I mean, I think your question of like, how do we do this? How do we reconnect? I think for me, it's like, and I, for me, this like comes to from, I feel like I've learned a lot about this through my queer ancestors and like through queer liberation, of just like following desire and following longing, and those being a form of wisdom, those being like a form of like, that's a practice in itself. And so like letting the desire and longing arise, like making a lot of space for desire and longing, and before we kind of foreclose upon that with grief and a sense of loss and the impossibility of knowing those things, like the same way that we do as like queer and trans people, is like, you know, protect that desire as holy and sacred and full of life. And, you know, like, where does that desire want you to go? Like deep into some cavern, up into the stars, into a synagogue, out into the fields, into text, you know, studying with all the amazing people who are sharing a lot of wisdom right now, letting it be a guide. And also, you know, of course, at the same time, making space for the grief that comes up around like how and when and why there's been loss and disconnection. But I think like untwining them, like unbraiding those things, so that the feeling of longing and desire and interest isn't like the same, doesn't have the flavor of grief and loss and kind of like resignation about it, you know. And you know, I think that the Jewish tradition has this tradition of study with friends. It's called Hevruta, which is like shares the root with the word friend. It's like a study friend. And I think there's so much wisdom in that ancestral practice of like, you know, I think there's a lot of beauty in doing things on our own and in solitude and in quiet. And, you know, I'm like also, I'm a sort of extroverted hermit. And so I value a lot of study on my own too. And I think that there is a way that like bringing people in with you. And, you know, I think as a person who was raised in a very vibrant Jewish community, I really see the way that community helps us practice, like that rituals, moving through time, doing these things that have to do with life and death and meaning, like it's helpful to do them with others holding that space with you and holding those intentions with you. So I also think like doing it with friends, doing it in community. And then I think, you know, letting it live in your body, giving yourself space and time, like, you know, learning about doing research. Like I'm a nerd, and I, like, for me, that's for sure been one of my most treasured spiritual practices. Like, what are the recipes and can I cook them? What did they grow and can I grow it? What are the songs they sang? I'm gonna learn them. Just like this immersion, following the calendar, like being in like full negation of capitalist time and being like, I'm gonna follow the moon the way that my ancestors have for 2000 years. And then like, for me, it feels like really essential just to ground it and also let it infuse my politics so that these practices, this practice of reconnecting to this wisdom, is part of divesting from white supremacy and patriarchy, and also like continuing to let these practices support us in showing up for, you know, pointing these legacies towards liberation, divesting from cultural appropriation. And, you know, I think like you, for me, the plants have been, the plants have really been a way for me personally to do this. And I feel like really resonate for a lot of people because they are living beings. They are part of our ancestry. These memories travel on their scent and their taste. And so that for me has been a really embodied way to reconnect and re-enliven and re-enchant these wisdoms and memories.
Started speaking about plants, I was going to ask you a very different question, but now that you brought plants up, I perked up, and I'm thinking about herbalism and our connection to plant allies and how we work with plants, whether that's through food or medicine making or growing or harvesting, tending, or just being with, praying to, building relationship with, and so on and so forth. And I think that being with plants in one way is so natural and simple and just is this relationship beyond time. But on another end of the spectrum, it's also complex and deep and complicated as we have grown into these modern humans. And so I would love to just open a question up to you about your relationship with plants and how you build your relationship with them in terms of using them as medicine or as food or just being with them. I think a lot of us, I remember for me, when I started to become interested in getting closer to plants, it was this big question of what does that mean and how do you do it? And, you know, it's one thing to just buy a tincture at the store, which is great, and I really support people in doing that. But I think that there's a lot of questions that could come up of, am I doing it right? Or what is respectful? How do we deepen these relationships? How much time does it take? And even questions around honorable harvest. I know I'm throwing out a lot right now, but I'm just doing that kind of laying a buffet for you of questions around plants to see what feels alive for you in this moment and what you could share with us about your relationship.
I love that the plants just like took over the interview. You were like, I was going to ask you these other things, but then you said the word plants and now we have to talk about plants. Yeah, it's like that. Well, okay. There's so many things that you said that I'm like, we could, like, where should we go first? Well, you know, I think that first, I guess I want to respond to the question that you brought up or the feeling that you brought up of like, I want to be respectful. And then there's also like the kind of shadow side of that, of like questioning oneself, am I doing it right? And, you know, like, is it okay? And I think it's like, to me, it reminds me of this Jewish teaching where this rabbi, and now I can't remember what my, now that I'm going through perimenopause, all names have left my brain, which I'm taking it. I'm just like, there's wisdom in this actually. So some rabbi, and I can look it up later and tell you, has this teaching that you're supposed to keep these two scraps of paper in your pockets, one on one side and one on the other. And on one side, the scrap of paper says, like, there's no one like you. You're the only one that is you. This sort of like message of like your innate divinity and like the exceptional miracle that is you. And then in the other pocket, there's a little note that says, you're dust, you're dirt, you're just like everybody else. You are like, both, there's like a humility to it and also like, you're special, everyone's special, you know, we're all made of the same stuff. And I think that, you know, being willing to be in the wrestling and to hold these contradictions that aren't really, you know, contradictory, of like, give yourself permission, be willing to make mistakes, play, you know, really invite in a spirit of play and not having to be right and purist about it. Like, I think, and I think giving each other permission and giving each other like just a lot of love and forgiveness and space to not know and to be like, I'm just going to try this thing. Gosh, there's just so much pressure. I think especially in a culture where like also everybody's so public about everything on social media, to like just be right, get it right, be really good. And I just like, I really want us to dissolve that and be able to like be creative. Process is so messy. Getting to know who you are is so messy. And so like, how can we give each other a lot of space to play? And at the same time, like being in integrity and being respectful and bringing in this kind of reverence for the plants and the ancestors is imperative. And so I think like, yeah, both, right? Like we need to bring both into our practices. And and my sense is that it's sort of like, for a lot of us, we lean one way or the other harder, right? So some of us may be really hard on ourselves and feel like we, you know, can't give ourselves permission to be messy or to not know or to try something new. And because of that, we tend to be harder on ourselves and probably are more interested in doing the things that are about like rigor and integrity and a lot of questioning, right? And the people who, you know, are a little bit more, you know, whatever, careless, I guess, not in a way that's like because they want to hurt people, but or maybe they feel more entitled, or maybe they've experienced a lot of entitlement, and so it may not come as naturally to them to be as thoughtful about like the impact that they have, or their own power or whatever. And so because of that, they're not going to tend to bring a lot of rigor or precision to learning and practicing. And so it's like, this is why also it's really good to do these practices and learn together, is because we can learn from each other and be like, okay, if you're a person who, you know, maybe feels like whatever, it's fine, just, oh, you don't have this, use this. Like, learn from those who bring a little bit more precision. And if you're a person who tends to be really hard on yourself, like getting to be with kind of what more wild and free people and just be like, I'm just going to try this and I don't know what it's going to be like. And it might be a mistake, but it'll be a learning, you know? So I think there's that piece to the question of like, you know, how we practice these things.
I won't lie, it's been tough, the way you look through me, like we never knew love. Gotta go on, guess you won't be by my side. How many years we added up, how they disappeared while you got stuck. They say to hold on, the time will set it right.
I do want to get into a topic that is, I'd say, tough for a lot of us. And I want to ask you about reclaiming Judaism from Zionism and solidarity with a free and sovereign Palestine. So I'm wondering if you could speak to the shared interest between Palestinian liberation from Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid and Jewish divestment from Zionism.
Thanks for this question, Ayana. And I think I'm speaking from my perspective, my experience as a white Jewish person in the US. And, you know, I just wanna say, like, I've been involved in organizing around Palestinian liberation in Jewish community for a really long time. And I think for me, like, the shared interest is just that I truly believe that our liberations are entwined, you know, and that all liberation and struggles for liberation is tied up together. And that I think, like, coming from a place of just believing that all people deserve to live in dignity, that all people deserve to be free from harm. And then for me explicitly as a Jewish person in the US, it's like, I feel like it's part of my, it's part of my work to undo and resist Zionism, because, like, as a project of settler colonialism, for one, like, I believe in dismantling settler colonialism in all of its forms and undoing empire everywhere for everyone's liberation. And then as a Jew, like, you know, in the US and also in occupied Palestine, as that is a project that's being done that purports to create Jewish safety and or to solve Jewish safety. And, you know, Judaism is thousands of years old, and the state of Israel is not even 100 years old, you know? And so I guess I feel like it's really important to remember that, because I think those of us who get involved in this, like, it can just, like, the coming up against empire can feel so impossible. And that, I always find that to be, like, when I think about time, you know, it's a way that I work, even when I'm feeling disheartened about the destruction of our planet, or, you know, anything that's sort of like where I begin to really feel into feeling disheartened or hopeless or small or insignificant, like, to remember time, like big time, often is a really helpful practice for me. So when I think about how young Zionism is, and also like really understand its roots, like, I also am like, this is like, it's not actually complicated. I think that's one myth. And it's really young, and it really is, like you said, it's a settler colonial project. And I feel like, for me, that is antithetical to, for lack of a better word, like Jewish theology, Jewish spirituality, Jewish values. And I'm not alone in this. This is not like my original thinking, like that this is like empire kind of co-opting and militarizing a tradition. Like, this is ethno-nationalism. And so I think, like, you know, as part of my practice, as doing all of this beautiful reconnecting with and teaching about and practicing these Jewish traditions, like, I am also attuning to the legacies of resistance and healing, and like pulling from these threads of like these practices in rebellious history as a counterspell to ethno-nationalism, as a counterspell to militarization and carceral systems. And I'm really interested in connecting with these ancestral practices, because I think they offer us resource, alternative support, and counterspells to creating safety through the state, which we know doesn't create safety, which we know just creates more insecurity, does harm and destruction for everyone, and especially for, you know, in for Palestinians. And so, you know, I think what a lot of like Jews in the US are reckoning with is like, well, what does it mean when one's sense or illusion of safety is like actually directly harmful and impacting the safety of other people? And yeah, I think it is, these are hard questions, but I think like for me, it is part of the practice of like, we don't just get to connect with these beautiful lineages of plant magic without reckoning with and being with the harms that are being done in occupied Palestine. And for me, they're very connected. You know, I mean, there's lots of different ways to dismantle empire, to resist empire. And for me, this is like part of my practice and part of my work. And, you know, it's part of a larger, you know, larger, longer work than me, than all of us, of resistance. And I guess like I have like a hope and a prayer that, you know, that my work can be part of, well, I guess like to connect it with, like, so I don't think it's separate from what we were talking about before. It doesn't feel like a diverging from talking about garlic and cedar, because, you know, in my work, like what I'm really interested in is that like for thousands of years, Jews have had these practices of carrying garlic and wearing amulets and participating in a multitude of expressions of collective care. to cultivate safety, to cultivate protection for ourselves and our communities. And like these practices weave and are woven from connection and presence, connection to ourselves, to each other, to place, to elements, to earth, to ancestors and ancestral tradition, to life itself, you know, or whatever word you want to use for divinity and mystery. And I do think inherent these practices are actually like full of liberatory potential and impulses, that they are embodied, that they're relational, that they're reciprocal, that they're not an extractive and life-affirming and built in kinship, you know? And I think like I can flow right from talking about cedar and garlic to talking about how this work is very much a part of resisting, undoing empire, and specifically Zionism. And I can say more on that specifically, or I don't know if there's like questions arising that you have that are specific about that.
I really appreciate what you've shared so far. And if there is more that you're thinking of at this moment, I'm happy to continue listening. I think it's really important for us to hear.
Well, I guess I think about how, you know, we know that a well-worn tool of oppression is to try to separate people from our life-sustaining traditions, from our practices, from the ways in which we feel connected to each other, the way we're connected to land. And, you know, this like attempt to sever these invisible webs of support and lineage and a sense of belonging to each other. And I think that, you know, systems of domination rely on severing these connections. And the threat of violence and obliteration and loss of connection leaves people feeling really vulnerable and afraid. And that in turn really, I think, becomes fertile ground for adopting toxic mimics of protection, like seeking safety in assimilation or hiding, kind of like contracted and being exclusive, hypervigilance, wealth accumulation or hoarding, land acquisition, land theft, and also relying on false promises of the state for safety. And so I feel like reconnecting with these practices, but in the spirit of divestment, is a form of resistance, you know? And the way that empire, I think, really reduces our capacity and reduces our participation and is invested in disconnection, both from each other and from land and from these traditions. And it's like, you know, when we reconnect with these like beauty-filled practices in service to dismantling empire, you know, I think that this work can be an invitation to divest from Zionism and these, you know, the ideas that Zionism, like the imperatives of Zionism, like spiritual hierarchy and messianism and birthright and homeland and stuff, and like the way that Zionism positions itself as the ultimate arbiter of Jewish theology and spirituality and the ultimate source of Jewish safety, right? And so this is one idea, and sort of like I feel really inspired by, like, you know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Angela Davis and Maryam Kaba and Black feminist abolitionists who talk about that abolition is not just about dismantling, but abolition is about world building and building the world to come, which that part, you know, as a Jew, like that part I feel really connected to is the Jewish concept of Olam Haba'av, of building towards the world we dream of the world that could be, that we get a taste of on Shabbat. And that in order to build towards the world that we want to live in, and for me, and for a lot of people, that means a Judaism beyond Zionism, we need to be practicing what a Judaism beyond Zionism can look like. We need to be living and practicing and doing things that build the world that we want to live in, a world beyond that, like without creating safety through militarism and policing and carceral systems. And so, you know, I think like when we reconnect with these practices, but also like breathe life into their liberatory potential, it can not just like offer us radical possibilities and counterspells, but also like I am interested in the ideas of how it can help us redefine what safety means or what protection means, and that it's not just about magic. It's not just about like, oh, like garlic is going to keep me safe, so we don't need cops. You know, it's not obviously that simple. But I think a lot of these, what these practices do is that they're expressions of interdependence. They're expressions of life and of loving life and of presence. They're practices of mutual aid. They are non-extractive. And so think that they can be part of this world building. They can be part of this dismantling. And I think like because of the history of these practices, which have to very much to do with where white supremacy, where Christian hegemony, where patriarchy have impacted Jewish practices and kind of like these sites of assimilation. So it's not just like about divesting from Zionism, but it's also like doing this kind of this healing work from all these ways that we lost these practices in the maw of assimilation, which, you know, was one way that we are, you know, many people survived. So I think like when I talk about these practices, it's not simple or romantic or nostalgic, but like really remembering the way that these practices have bound us to each other and bound us, like tethered us to life itself. And like that these practices were always held communally and with a prayer like to imagine beyond the current structures and systems and kind of like weave ourselves into and be wrapped inside of the invisible cloak that's interdependence, that's mutual aid, that is like helps us, supports us to reach towards each other and reach towards a vision of mutually flourishing life, of generosity, of true belonging. That's not about belonging to a state, right? That's not about belonging like in this false way that that's the only way we can belong is through nationalism. But that's really about like a safety that is truly, you know, like with that holds the complexity that safety can't be guaranteed, that safety is totally like relational, that we create safety with each other. And yeah, I guess it's like my prayer that like for me, like this work is very much an integration personally of my politics and ways in which I've been in organizing spaces for a long time. And also, you know, my healing practice, and that for me, those things are not separate. And I'm really excited to be in communities, in conversations with you and with so many of the people who, you know, listen to your podcast, where these things are being woven together in really beautiful, complicated, supportive ways. And I just feel grateful to get to be a part of that web.
Oh, Dori, I am so grateful that you are a part of the web. It's been such an incredible time with you today. I really feel a deep yearning to have a part two, because I feel that as deep as this conversation went, I think we just began to scratch the surface of so many topics. And yeah, I really appreciate your energy and your devotion and the way that you see the world and spirituality. And I think in this time, what really our largest trouble is a type of spiritual bankruptcy, which has led us to this place of immense disconnection from the earth. And so hearing your words was like honey on the heart, and it felt really soothing. And I really appreciate your storytelling. I think we're missing that so much, getting so reductionist in the way we understand and things and the way we feel like we have to explain things to have validity. And I really loved hearing your stories, and the weavings were so captivating. Like, I really was at the edge of my chair wanting to.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now.